Hey everyone, what's up? Welcome to episode 7 of the Everyday Bowhunter Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Manley. This week, my brother Dan and I dig into a listener question about arrows and arrow weight. Then we dive into all the gear that nobody really talks about that you can't forget to take with you this season when you're hunting. We really dig into a bunch of stuff that really nobody talks about. So hang on for that. And then we also go into the last minute scouting we're doing, when to avoid going back in the woods, and how to find and hunt that hot sign that you need to be successful this year. So let's get ready to dive into it, and let's go. Welcome to the Everyday Bowhunter. I'm your host, Mike Manley, retired Green Beret turned bowhunter, joined by my brother, Dan Zeemer. We're here to share tips, stories, and talk gear, all from our unique points of view. Whether you're just starting out, or you're a seasoned bow hunter, I think you're gonna like it. So let's go. All right, welcome to episode 7. Ready to kick it in, Dan?
Hey, we're back. Let's
go. All right, now I'm gonna start this pod off a little off kilter. This is just it's one of those stories that you put in that box, which are hard to believe, but it actually happened to me on Labor Day. And so we had built this kayak. We had built this kayak trailer, my wife and I.
I remember seeing you build it. Yeah.
130 some bolts and pieces. That was just a nightmare. But anyway, so we took the kayaks down to Susquehanna and we're getting ready to put in. Right. And as we're putting in, there's the guy with his family, his wife and like a 12-year-old kid, and they're putting in as well in the smallest John boat you've ever seen. Now, this boat is loaded to the gills with stuff, coolers, fishing gear, you name it. And then he put the family in there and I'm saying, hey, boat's a little full. That's going to ride pretty low in the water. And he's like, well, I'm giving it a shot. This is my first boat ever and my first time putting it in the water. And I'm like, okay. You know, and I'm like, I go up and help my wife push off on her kayak. She's out in the water. And then I go over to them and he's like, hey, can you help push us, you know, into the water? I'm like, sure. So I go and I lift it up and push him out and everything. So I'm getting into my kayak and I get myself in the water and I'm going out to meet my wife. And all of a sudden, this guy starts yelling, help, help, I need help. My trolling motor doesn't work. And his wife and the kid have these oars that are like, I don't know, like the 3-foot oars type things. And they're like putting them in the water and nothing's happening. And they're going downstream. Right. They're going downstream. So I'm in a kayak. You know, my wife's in a kayak. Well, anyway, Tanya, my wife, gets closer and they throw her a rope. And I said, there's no way she's doing anything. So I motor over, I get around, I put the rope around my waist and I just start hammering it with the kayak. And I pulled them about, I don't know, maybe 50 yards. You know, 50 yards in a kayak pulling a boat, heavy boat like that. I was smoked. Luckily, there was another guy putting in, and he didn't wait for his family. He saw what was happening. He put in, came around with his boat. I threw him the rope, and he towed him the rest of the way to the boat ramp. But I was like, oh, my God.
Amateur hour on the river.
Man. I was like, he didn't make sure that his trolling motor was charged.
The battery.
And I mean, it's one of the, you know, it's just doing your.
Here you are on a major holiday. That ain't the time. I mean, I guess it is because you had people there to help, but.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's his only saving grace because he went into panic mode. He was screaming, how deep's the water here? Can I get in? But, you know, like if he could get out and just pull the boat back in. But,
well, how deep was it? I mean, if you just probably like 5-6 feet.
I don't know. Tanya put her oar down. It couldn't touch the bottom. So he was like, I ain't getting in that.
Did you put in on the York side?
Yes. Down at Wrightsville, yeah.
Yeah. The Columbia side, it's shallow for a good 50, 60 yards out, you know, until it drops off a little bit.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we went and then finally, you know, could relax, but I started off my kayak and already tired. I was whooped. Trying to pull a boat with a kayak is not exactly the best case scenario.
Anyway. I mean, this literally sounds like something that would happen to me and Dad. Like,
yeah, you can't make it up.
Can't fix stupid.
So anyway, we'll get into the podcast here. Now, what we want to do is start off with, you know, listener questions, just to kind of kick the pot off each week, kind of a new thing we want to do. And one of the questions I got was through the blog, and it asked, hey, you know, in your last episode, you talked a lot about arrows and why they're important and that was one of your biggest lessons learned, but you really didn't go into details. Now, we've kind of hit this subject a couple times across a couple pods, and I thought I'd just quickly answer this, and then you can add your two cents to it too, Dan.
Roger that.
So first off, why arrow weight matters? Well, first, if you take a pencil, a number two pencil, super sharp, 5 yards, you throw it as hard as you can at the wall. What's going to happen? It might stick or it might bounce off, right?
Sure.
But you take a hammer, ball peen hammer, at that same 5 yards, and you throw it as hard as you can, it's going through the drywall.
Yeah.
Right? It's penetrating. And that whole reason is mass. So it has that mass, right? But also, if you back up 10 yards with that hammer, you might just get enough to dent it and not get through the wall.
You're going to lose kinetic energy. Yeah.
You're going to lose kinetic energy. So the whole thing is that there's a upper spectrum and a lower spectrum. For example, if you shoot a 300 grain arrow, there's a chance that you might get minimal penetration. But if you shoot a 600 grain arrow, it might blow through the deer, right? Because of that mass. But there's a middle ground. Every single person has their optimal weight arrow. And of course, we could throw in FOC and you know, the front end weight of your arrow. It went that above 13%, but that's just that's, you know, aside from the subject. The subject is the weight. So you have to find that basic, you know, bell curve spot where your kinetic energy and momentum and speed are all perfectly aligned, so you're not dropping off the scale, and that's the best for you. So it might be 500, like me. I came out to like 498 for me. And it could be 550 for somebody else. And if you have like a 32-inch draw, it could be 650, you know? Yeah. So it's all those things to take into consideration. But that's why arrow weight matters, because the amount of force, the amount of mass, and how fast it hits that deer optimally is going to, you know, take you from a glancing, you know, if you don't have a perfect broadside shot, to where it bounces off or just sticks in it. Inside them a little bit, and they're running away with the arrow flopping on them, to where, you know, you have a 550 grain arrow with a great, and the broadheads matter too, of course, and it blows through the deer, blows through bone and everything else. So
yeah,
that's my two cents on that question. What do you got, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you said. I mean, draw length and draw weight have everything to do with that.
Absolutely.
So you have to take into consideration if, like, me per se, I'm only drawing 60 pounds because I have this tore muscle. So I can pull back more, but it would, like, if you're practicing shooting a lot, it's going to tear me up. So anyway, to make a long story short, I have to stay a little bit lighter on the edge. You know, I have to be a little bit lighter because of my draw length or weight. Mm-hmm. And I'm 27 and a half draw length. So, you know, mathematically, I want to pass through, I want to break bones. So I opted to go heavier. I'm not necessarily worried about speed. I really don't want to shoot outside of a, you know, 20 to 30 yard range. And I think if I'm keeping that my window, I can stay heavier, still have enough speed, but get that kinetic energy through a heavier arrow to accomplish what I want. And I don't want deflection. So I've seen it happen. I had it, you know, it was a lethal result, but I, you know, take out some of the problems that could happen. And, you know, that's where I stand with, you know, arrow weight. You have to know all your math before you go in and get these arrows. You know, it's, mm-hmm.
Now, there's two things that you can affect that increase your speed, kinetic energy, and momentum. There's only two things you can change. Yeah. That's the bow you're shooting.
Right.
And your draw weight, because your draw length is set. You can't change your draw length. And that actually has the biggest effect on it overall, because you're not pulling the string back far enough, or as far as somebody else with like a 30-inch or 32-inch.
I do have a question, and maybe you're the guy to answer this. So it's my, like my bow, I can set the pounds let off. Okay. So mine goes from 70, 80, or 90. Mm-hmm. And they say at 90, it's really easy to hold back for a long period of time, but you lose a lot.
Yeah.
Right. So technically if I'm right about this, with me being only 60 pounds draw, I want to be at 70 pound let off to make it snappier, to get more out of it. Am I right about that?
If you do,
is that logic of thinking?
That would do it. Yeah. That would give you a little more. Now, each bow specifically, when they give you that FPS for the max for the bow. So, you know, you have a Matthews and it says it's rated at 325 feet per second.
Right.
That's with like a 5 grain per inch arrow and a 30 inch draw length and whatever let off, had lost it. Whatever let off that they set it to, and that could be at 80, right? They could have 80% as their set that they did for that. And that's what that speed is. So, but when you adjust that let off, that speed now can go up or down based on that.
Right. Nate at Stream Archery said, hey, to get the most out of that bow, it's 60 pound max, I'll max it out, but you're going to want to do 70 pound let off. You're going to get more out of it. You can go 80 because your shoulder later, if you find that 70 is too much, but he goes, I would like to see you start at, and there you go again, having a great technician dialing you in is everything. Cause sometimes you're not thinking about the little things, just going to that bow shop and having that tech, a professional dial you in. It's everything.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a great question. I hope we answered it. We really went into some detail there. I hope that answers all your questions. If you have more questions, obviously you can, on YouTube, put your questions in the comments, let us know, we'll go over it the next pod, or, on archeryhunting.com, go in there to the contact us page and we'll, be sure to get you, that question answered on the next pod if we can. So we'd love to hear from you, and more questions are better.
We're going
to feature one, at least one or two each week.
And asking us questions, we might not have the answer, but we could find it for you. And me and Mike are going to learn too in the process sometimes.
Absolutely.
I think
we definitely don't know everything.
Yeah. No doubt.
That's why it's the everyday bow hunter. So anyway, with this episode, what we're diving into is we're going to talk about gear prep and the key pieces of gear that we use that no one really talks about, but are kind of essential for bow hunters. Everybody talks about the bow and the tree stand and all that other stuff, but there's a lot of other nitty gritty stuff that we really don't talk about that can really help somebody out, especially when you're starting out and you need to know, hey, I really needed this in the woods. Well, we always carry this, or I always carry it, or Dan carries something else. So we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
But the first thing we talk about, Dan, is what hunting clothes are you using for the early season, and how does that change for you as it gets colder, and what camo are you using and why?
Okay. So me personally, early season, I'm going like Traverse or Scentlock has great, I think it's the Savannah gear. That's great early season. It's real light. I personally, that's, my window that leads me into mid-season. In mid-season, you kind of start ramping up on thicker base layer, stuff like that. And I mean, our mid-season's still kind of mild, so you could keep your early season top on, just go heavier with the base layer. I like to do that. And of course, when you get closer to rut, that's where I'm getting into the bibs and stuff like that. But now my early season thought process camo pattern is, I like that subalpine because everything's so green and lush. I think the subalpine kind of really blends with me hunting off the ground. That really blends great. you head into mid season when the leaves start changing colors, that's where I kind of go mossy oak. That way I'm kind of more blending in with those colors. Mossy oak brings that out. And then, you know, later when the leaves start coming off, you have more of that open background, so to speak. It's more, I call it barren wasteland, you know, when the leaves are off. And that's where I kind of do the elevated too. Mm-hmm. That most of my, you know, farther into rut season is all Sika gear pretty much. And that's, I have the elevated too. That's my setup.
Okay. So for me, you know, with it being hot, if obviously you want a wicking layer, cause you're going to sweat, you need that wicking layer, that light layer. And the one thing we talked about earlier is the bugs.
Yeah.
This year, especially, I mean, I've been in the woods scouting and the bugs have been horrendous.
So it's always good to prep with this.
Yeah. Permethrin. Yeah. Treat your hunting clothes with permethrin. It's supposed to be odor free when it dries. I don't know what the deer could smell on that, but.
And they say it's a couple wash cycles too. It lasts.
Yeah. I think if you do the spray on, it might last like 6 or 7 wash cycles. So it can last you through the whole hunting season. Yeah. Not that you usually need it that long.
Right.
But that's why I got, and I'm testing out this year, I got the Sika Equinox Guard pants and hoodie, and they have the insect shield stuff built into it.
Right.
And the insect shield stuff, it's not just Sika specific. Insect Shield is an actual company. They sell their own products, et cetera. Okay. But what they do is they embed permethrin into the clothes themselves or into the material themselves. And before it even made into a pants or whatever, and it's supposed to last either lifetime of the garment or 70 washes, which I don't know how you measure that, but it's a lot of washes. So anyway, the pants are really good. They got side zips on them and stuff for venting out, you know.
Yeah.
They're a little bit heavier. I think it's going to help carry me into the midseason more, like you're talking about. I can throw a base layer under there. And still vent out when I'm walking in, you know, when you're doing a good hike and stuff. And that bottom layer then can also be used as a wicking layer. And then I have that Sika ambient hoodie, throw in the pack. I can pull that out when it gets chillier and stuff. But I'm also testing Four Lows insect shield setup too. I'm testing that. And I have a whole slew of clothes that I don't want to get into right now that I'm testing through the season. That would be a whole episode. So, but that's kind of where I stand. And like you, my camo thing is I try to stick with whatever the background looks like. And you're dead on that Sika, Optifade Subalpine is meant for that ground hunting scenario that you're talking about. That's what it's built for. They did massive testing on deer vision with that. And they have, it's called a disruption style camouflage. So it's supposed to confuse a deer with micro and macro dispersion. And I think that's a great camo setup. I'm using that. I'm using Elevated 2.
Yeah.
I'm using Osseo Gear's stuff, which has their raptor camouflage. It's like an owl and stuff. So there's a couple different things I'm testing. And who the heck knows what works the best until. Because so many scenarios that you can get busted on, it's hard to tell what camo is great and what's
like for me. So Mossy Oak does make, what the heck is the name of it? It's a line in Mossy Oak that looks like tree bark, ground cover, whatever it's called.
Bottomland.
Thank you. And I should probably invest more into that now that I'm ground hunting, because if I'm up against trees more in certain setups, if I know that setup, I'm going to be using that, you know, Summit tree seat, that stump seat, and to break up my silhouette is going to be that tree. I should be wearing something more bark, like, you know what I mean?
I think the old man's using something like that.
Yeah.
I got some of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good stuff. I mean,
yeah. So when it comes to the gear that you need that, you know, people, we talk, you know, talk about. But the gear you need that people don't talk about, the small stuff that really matters, what are you carrying into the woods? What's in your pack? And what stuff are you carrying to help you recover the deer post-shot?
I mean, there's your necessities. For me, it's a good pair of glasses, binoculars. The rangefinder is the elite of the essential, you know, for me. That's without a doubt, always in the pack. Can't not have it. And then from that point, you know, wherever that's going to fall, thermals, wind direction, you know.
Milkweed. He was dropping. Dave was dropping milkweed, and now he's using his.
It's a good locator of deer.
Can.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's simple things, you know, of course, your knife, because if you're successful, you will need it, you know, a good sharp knife. But, you know, speaking on that success, good drag rope. Sorry, Mike, I know the father-in-law did not make you one, just me and Dad, but he ended up retiring before he could make one. But, you know, a good drag rope is pretty important, you know, if you're going to be successful.
I'll stain it bloody.
Now, I mean, for me, there is, I just lost the name of it. This looks like underarm deodorant.
Oh, you're talking about the, oh my God, I can't.
Evercom.
Evercom, yeah.
You know, Evercom, with me being on the ground, I feel like, you know, the guy in the tree, it's not as essential for me to kind of mask my, you know, residual scent that I'm letting out with a little bit of herd smell, bedding smell, you know, is pretty important. So that's something that I'm always carrying too. You know, that's kind of my essentials right there that I have in my bag. Well, sure. Grunt tube for later, you know, grunt, you know, that's pretty damn important too. So.
Yeah. I was taking out all my stuff and laying it out and then open up. I have a bin that I have all my stuff in for the whole archery season that I take to camp with me and stuff. And I was pulling all this stuff out then. And I was like, oh my God, I am so behind on getting my gear ready. And I thought I was ahead. Yeah. And I was like, wow, I need to put this here and that there. And I pulled out, you know, I have my hunting license in my pack now. It's already there. I got my knife with a gut hook on it. I have my multi-tool, Leatherman multi-tool that's in there. So I can, you know, fix stuff and have the pliers and stuff if I need it. I have my Allen wrenches. So if I need to do any bow maintenance in the woods, which I've had to do in the past. And if you have a broadhead issue, that Leatherman helps as well. Mm-hmm. Of course, the milkweed, as you already said, have that stocked up and ready to go. And it's also about, like I said, the last episode, I make sure, like in my saddle, I have the pouches on the sides. I make
drop
sure
bags that, or what are you? Yeah. Dump bags, yeah.
Yeah, the magazine dump pouches that are used for putting your mags in after you shoot a bunch of guys in the overseas. But what? Was that wrong? But anyway, let's move on.
It is what it is. That was your career. I mean,
but anyway, I put stuff in there. Like, I'll have the milkweed down at the bottom of that. But on top of that, I'll have, you know, my lineman's rope come out first, and then I'll have my, in there, I have my tree strap that has all my hooks on for all the things I'm going to hook around the tree. Like you said, your binoculars, your grunt tube, you know, your bow hanger, so you can hang your bow in the tree since I'm up in the tree.
Yeah.
You know, have all those things. I have a bunch of camera stuff, the camera arm that I'm taking with the camera set up, GoPro set up, and all the stuff that comes with the cameras. So that's a lot of gear. And this season, I guess, not every hunt, but this season I'm going to be testing Ovzonics as well. We got the HR 500 unit, and that thing's got some weight to it. So I ain't going to be carrying that all the time. But like I said, I have no expectation. And
I know it's so hard.
That thing does make a sound. The fan, you can hear that fan. So,
oh, really?
Oh, yeah, you can hear the fan. Okay. So I'm wondering how that's going to be. You know,
well, that's now. How high above you do you have to put it? Does it say?
They say 6 to 12 inches above, and
that's it.
And you point it like a 30-degree angle.
Okay.
Because they want the ozone to come down in front of you.
Right. Yeah.
So as your scent goes forward, that comes in downwind, but you want that to cover your downwind side. So if a deer, you know, wind checks you or something like that, I don't know. We'll see. I'll test it. You know what? I'll try anything once.
So real quick, this might sound a little petty, but there's two things that are a necessity if you're successful. And a zip tie. You got to be able to sign that tag, and you got to be able to, like in Pennsylvania, our law is you got to cut the ear and hang it to the ear. So a zip tie, I mean, I know this sounds trivial or whatever, however you say that, but it's absolutely necessary. You know what I mean? Got to have that pen, got to have a zip tie.
If you get twisty. If you get caught by, you know, game warden or something, you're going to be through. They don't.
Look, here's the thing. You can't preach ethics and not be ethical. You know what I mean? If you're going to talk, you got to walk the walk and do it right.
Yeah.
That's part of hunting. You guys got to do it right.
I have my Havilon knife with me and stuff too. Of course, flashlight, headlamp, and the very specific thing that I've really switched to is ensuring that my headlamp is red light capable. So when I'm getting within 200 yards of my stand, I kind of switch to red light and maybe even sooner depending on where I'm at. So to get that minimal approach to the stand that I'm not really put my signature out with the white light. So that's something that I have changed, and we'll see how that goes. Makes it a little slower going, which is okay, because as you're going in there, you don't want to make as much noise and stuff.
I mean, that's hard on me because I kind of deal with a lot of night blindness. And if I go red, it's almost a blackout for me, you know, and that's unfortunate and it is what it is. So I kind of got to stay white or green, but.
Yeah. But I mean, like the one thing is, when you're doing as far as a gear thing, and I just thought of this out of the blue,
right?
Because you're talking about the light, the UV brighteners, when you wash your clothes, don't use like Tide with brighteners and stuff in it. You know, even if you're not a scent control person, use the wind. Mm-hmm. The one thing that deer can really see is ultraviolet light. And if you have UV brighteners on your clothing, you can actually stand out more to a deer, even if you have the best camouflage in the world on. So it's one of those things to take into consideration. Use a laundry detergent that's no scent and doesn't have any of those UV brighteners in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I generally wash my hunting clothes. Scent Away makes a laundry detergent, and I use that because it's odorless. I don't, you know, and they have like an autumn scent too, but I think that could screw you up in early season because the leaves ain't falling yet. You don't want that autumn smell. That would kind of throw them off, you'd think.
Yeah. I try to just go with the scent. Scent free.
Yeah, I definitely go with the odorless. Yeah.
Now, as far as scent control stuff goes, just on a normal basis, we shower with the soaps and put the deodorants on and all that for the scent free stuff. You know, trying to minimize your signature. Deer can still smell it, but it's all about minimizing your signature. I carry the bath wipes almost, the heavy duty scent free wipes, because in the early season, when I get to the tree, I'm wiping that stuff off because I'm just, you know, foreign sweat. And that's why I also like those hoodies that have the zipper, the half zip, so you can have it open and air blowing through when you're walking into your spots, so you don't sweat as much if possible. Sometimes like the heat now, some of those guys that are hunting right now in like Tennessee and Kentucky
in 90 degree heat, that's crazy.
We
did that down Delaware, me and Dad, a couple years back, and it was like 88 90 degrees. I'm sitting in a blind and I was just cooking in that thing. I was, you were talking earlier before the podcast about one of them rotisserie chickens from Giant. I felt like one of them in that blind, man. Dude, it's hot in a blind when it's that hot out, you know. But oh, real quick. Sorry, I have some still blowing around here, milkweed. We're talking about gear, clothing, you know, and I did want to say that I just started using, and it's more for my early season. I mean, I could wear it through, but I got that Hex gear.
Oh yeah.
HECS. So my first real encounter with this Hex gear is we were hunting that edge of the field. I think it was opening weekend or whatever. And I had a very young doe or button buck, whatever it was. I mean, almost run right at me. Like, I was like, dude, it's going to run right into me. Like, it blew me away because that takes your signature away, you know? And I was like, I mean, first time wearing the stuff out in the woods. And I was like, holy crap, instant results. So could it have been a fluke? That deer was running with its tongue out. It was running from something. And it could have been dad down farther spooked it out. But I was like, now I'm really interested going into this season to get more opportunities wearing that stuff to see how it works out.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd like to to see? Are you waiting to more mid-season to start wearing that?
No, I mean, it's super light. So you could actually double base layer with it. Like going into the later part of the season, you know what I mean? But early season, it's perfect, you know, with like that hex gear, because it comes with a hood, you know, a top and a bottom. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you can get the gloves and the socks to go with it, which I do not have yet. But, you know, at that point, just wear your regular early season stuff, like my, you know, subalpine traverse pants and top, you know, stuff like that to go with it. So it's going to be, I'm excited, man. You know, what are we? Like 18 days away? Something like that?
Close.
Yeah, oh my close. Gosh. It's like, 20 days or something like that. My head's spinning. I started packing my bag. I started putting things in and I'm just like I was almost shaky. Like, oh my God, it's almost time. I can't. Oh my God.
Except for the first week. Every week after that, I have every single Friday off. And then I have through the season, I have the week that we're going with Andy down there, has his cabin. Yeah. And then that whole week, the second week of November.
Well, so, I'm kind of the same way. Starting Andy's weekend, I have off that Thursday, Friday, the following week, Thursday, Friday, the following week, Thursday, Friday, and the following week, Thursday, Friday. So it's our asses are going to be in the seat. You know what I mean? We're going to get some good hunting in this year. I'm pumped, man.
Hey, I'm looking forward to it. And that's a good point to bring up. If you're listening to the pod or you're watching on YouTube, remember this, we are going to be putting all the content from season on here. It's going to be the good, the bad, the ugly, and the funny.
There's going to be plenty of ugly.
You know what? And learning more lessons. So that's great. But it's going to be an up and down season. It always is. You know, you have those frustrating hunts and you have the good ones. And so it's going to be fun. And we're going to be bringing it all to you. Sometimes maybe even from up at our camp, doing the pod straight from there.
I'm looking forward to going out to Musser's place, hunting that land, doing a podcast right from his camp, Camp Freedom. And, you know, that's going to be neat to have him back on and getting some hunting time with him. But, you know, if you want to keep moving here with gear, what kind of boots are you wearing?
So I got some muck boots, just muck rubber boots is what I'm wearing. It's kind of been a staple. I had these Field and Stream rubber boots that I got in 2011, and up until I wore them every year up until last year, and when they bombed out of me and tore. So they lasted me quite a while for those cheap boots, and they're uninsulated. Now I have a pair of lacrosse 1200 gram Thinsulate boots for when it gets really cold. That's my heavy duties, or they're my moon boots. Climbing trees in those are always, it's always interesting. But then I have my Merrell hiking boots that I wear sometimes when I'm going to go on a good trek. And because, you know, sometimes in those rubber boots, slide around and get blisters and stuff if you do a real long trek.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, I read a study about rubber boots, and, you know, I think it was Steve Rinella. It was a Meat Eater podcast. They're talking about, you know, the benefits of rubber boots versus actual hiking style hunting boots. And believe it or not, hiking style hunting boots won out everywhere but Pennsylvania of all places. So that's where we are, because there's so much water. We have so many little tributaries and stuff that feed it, you know, coming off the mountains. And
good rains through the fall. Oh, and it's just getting to some spots, you're going to trudge through some water. And I want to be prepared. I actually have a set of waders that, depending if I find the right spot that I have to cross a big creek or whatever, I'm going to throw them on and just kind of stash them on the other side and wait till I get back. So I'm ready to do it if I have to. In fact, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go down and I'm going to cross the water right down there from that little spot that you found, or that big, you know, bedding area and all those, that tracked up area there. With you and the old man scouted.
Ooh. Stay away.
Dan sent me a special signal.
Now, me hunting off the ground, I'm exclusively rubber boots. I hunt with the LaCrosse Alpha Burley Pro. I have, you know, zero insulation. I have 800 and I have thousands. So thousands, 1,000. That's now early season. I feel it's more of a necessity because it's more rainy, but snakes. I'm on the ground, dude. I want knee high boots. You know what I mean? It's just a little added protection.
Did you hear the old man said that up there at one of our family's camp that's up there in Lycoming County, that they killed 7 rattlesnakes around the camp. They couldn't even, you know, they don't like to kill them. They want to relocate them, you know, yeah. But they relocated a bunch and they were coming back. So, which is crazy, but yeah, that many rattlesnakes with kids running around the camp and stuff. They had a lot of little kids up there and stuff.
Yeah.
So they had to take action, but that's a heck of a lot of rattlesnakes. So yeah, early season, still warm like that. Yeah. I'm definitely having the rubber boots on.
Yeah. I the rubber boots for me, I had an encounter out, we call it county line. And I'm sitting there and I was like, what the hell is that noise? What am I hearing? You know? And I was on the ground and I was in my blind. And I just caught it out of the corner of my eye. Here comes a rattlesnake slithering down, coming right towards me. And I'm like, I mean, I never packed up a blind. And I mean, there was a Dan Zimmer size hole right through the other side of that blind. And I was going, man, dude, it scared the crap. I like snakes in pictures. But I'm not real big on them in person, rattlesnakes, copperheads, stuff like that. Now,
garters. You haven't hunted that spot since then, have you?
No, I haven't because of that reason. I know it sounds stupid, but it's like a PTSD. It's got me. So that's where I'm like, rule of thumb, wear knee high boots. I got to have a little bit of protection. We are too far away from a hospital. It's almost like copperhead or rattlesnake. I almost feel like we wouldn't make it there in time because we're so far out.
Yeah, you're only getting to that urgent care, and I don't know if they're prepared for that.
No, I don't know if they got the anti-venom.
Yeah. So we talked about gear, you know, going through it, but when all the gear's said and done and you're all ready to go out, you know, what are you looking for here, getting ready for the, you know, for the early season as far as sign? You know, what things are triggering that the Dan Spidey sense when you're going in?
So there's a term that we use that we have hashtags that we use. It's called FFDS. And what that means is fairly fresh deer shit. So if we see some FFDS when I'm hiking in, good shiny stuff, good clumpy stuff. That's really what I'm looking for. When the leaves start coming down, a lot of turned over leaves kicked up, you know, that's about as fresh as it can come aside from the FFDS is the kicked up leaves, you know, the scrapes, the rubs, all that good stuff. That's the hot sign I want. So if you're looking now early season, it's a little bit different because you don't have the foliage drop. So once the foliage drop and you see a scrape and there's a bunch of leaves in it, that A1 is telling me that that scrape has not been visited for a while. You want, when the leaves are dropping, maybe one leaf in there. And that tells me that that thing's been, and you're going to see like a moister dirt in the center of it that they've been, I don't want to say pawing at, but hooving at, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm looking for. Where they're browing, where they're chewing on brows, stuff like that. That's, you want to look for anything as fresh as you could see. You know, you don't want to see hoof prints that have been cut, you know, poke holes into the dirt that have been covered up or this. You want to see the freshest things possible. And that's what I'm looking for. And, you know, if you're not seeing that, it's probably pretty good to get out, reach out farther or go to a different area.
Now I had two experiences this past weekend because I went out and, did some scouting and I was trying to put in another cell camera for the season. Of course I couldn't get it to connect, so I didn't get to put it in, but the trip was worthwhile because when I went up in the side of the mountain, I was in that upper one third that we talk about, you know, with deer bedding and stuff. And I came across, I hit a scrape and I was like, ooh, this is mighty early for a scrape, you know, because I knew it wasn't there before because I traversed this area previously, you know, a couple times through the summer. And I went a little further and I hit another scrape and I'm like, what? Dan's still dropping milk. So, and then of course I go a little further and I hit what looks like a community scrape. It's right on the trail. There's a whole bunch of branches down and the branches are all just tore up. You know, you can see they're freshly broken off and stuff. And it was probably, I want to say easily 6-7 feet wide. And so it's right on the trail. It's not, you know, I was like, is this a turkey scratching?
Yeah. I was actually going to ask that. Like, you sure it wasn't turkey?
Her hoof prints in it. So I was like, wow, this is the biggest community type scrape that I've seen up in that area ever.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, and here's the bonus to it. Right off of there was where stream comes down the mountain, a drainage. And right next to there was also acorns dropping. Perfect. So
yeah,
I'm like, wow, this is telling me right now, if I was in season, if it was, I'd be right there right now.
Yeah.
Because that sign's telling me it's hot. It's ready to go. You have fresh grapes. You have food. You have water, especially because of the heat that we've had. Can't guarantee what the weather's going to be like here coming up. If you're going to have, you know, that water could be a crucial part of their regimen, that they need that water close by. So, but anyway, we went to another spot, and this spot we went up and it was close to my one camera where there's a lot of rocks and stuff. And down from there, about 200 yards down from that, where that camera is sitting, there was a dead beat down trail. I'm talking a funnel trail carved through the thick stuff going up through, and acorn patch halfway up it that was immense with really good tree at about 20 yards, 15, 20 yards. And I was like, this is a perfect east wind spot. And then up higher, I found a perfect west wind spot.
Yeah.
That I'd have to come in different angles on that spot altogether. But, but the kicker was a fresh rub. So had a fresh rub from getting the velvet off.
Right. I was just going to say velvet time. Yeah.
Yeah. Getting the velvet off, got food, got cameras confirming that there, I got two beautiful bucks in the area.
Yeah. Yeah. You said that one. Oh, that's a Jim Dandy.
Yeah. So things like that are triggering my spidey sense and saying, you know, you have, if you know where they're bedding, you know, where there's food, where they're getting drinks, you know, where their water is. And then you have that hot sign. That's that travel route that you need to be on. You know, when you can estimate that you can be there while they're on their feet.
Yeah.
Because if you get too far in between those areas, if you have a lot of distance, you know, that home range, like I said before, could be a mile, right? So you get that home range and then you go and say, boom, I can't be that far away. I need to be closer to bedding. So I can be tough.
Sorry, Porter was just walking around.
Yeah, I could hear the dog. That's no big deal. Yeah.
So
it's a little tip, tap. Yeah.
He's just checking on me. So because of timing here, do we want to go on to when your last day of scouting is?
So my last day of scouting was this last weekend.
Let
me put a time reference in there because for the listeners. So in Pennsylvania, if you're not familiar, Pennsylvania, the first day of archery season lands basically around the 1st of October, whatever Saturday that is, whether it's the September 30th, October 1st, 2nd, whatever that first Saturday is, either at the end of September or beginning of October is when the season starts. So if you take Labor Day, that was the last day I probably was in the woods, and I won't go in again because I do not want to trigger, you know, blow deer out and have them way off because I burn that area out from being in there too much. And you don't want to do that. The minimum I would say is 3 weeks. Don't go after 3 weeks. Don't go in. Don't check cameras. Understand what you got is what you got, and then do that in season scouting, because you don't want to take a hot spot and ruin it by constantly need to be in there and checking camera cameras or looking for more signs stuff. That's the wrong thing to do.
And I really don't have anything to add to that, because I am in 100% agreeance with you. And I'm done scouting until hunting season starts, and I do my traditional early season scout hunt, utilizing them first, 2 weeks to kind of locate, do some scouting, get out and see what's happening in the woods, and let that kind of lets me know everything I need to know to start patterning. Thank you. The deer getting an idea of, more of a plan for rut, Unless I'm hard up to get a doe right away, then I'm not going to be doing as much scout hunting. I'm going to be kind of just probably dialing in on one certain area where I know all the doe go. So,
yeah. But hey, there's one thing that Pennsylvania just totally screws up on in this regard, because in Pennsylvania, you're not allowed to put like stands in the woods on public land until 2 weeks before the season. Right. Yep. 2 weeks before the season.
And I get it. I mean,
they don't want it out there that long, but I think it should be a month.
I think it should be a month because of stopping your scouting the disruption, Yeah. Yeah.
And we were naive to that for a while. We went out. I mean, we've gone out the day before to help people find spots.
No, you want the deer to get used to seeing that set up there. If you're putting in a permanent blind for the season, 2 weeks is not long enough, in my opinion, for the deer to get used to seeing and smelling that setup there, and where they feel comfortable traveling by it again. I think a month, you're right,
Hey, well, the old man and I kind of broke the law on that a couple of years ago, and I paid the price for it. We took my blind out. I had never blind hunted, but I had a nice little field way out in the mountain. I mean, it's a mile and a half walk. And
China Bear showed up.
put the blind in. And it's like 2 weeks into the season, I think, right before my wife broke her leg. And I go out in the morning hunt. I walk in the dark way out there. I'm slinking in. I'm thinking I'm Johnny Badass. It's raining, the light little rain, not bad at all. I think, I get to sit in the blind and be dry. And I get there and it's completely destroyed. Completely destroyed, and has the claw marks in it and just ripped up. And I'm like, son of a bitch. Well, I had a camera in there, but I took it out. That was a huge mistake, having the blind there and not having the camera set over it.
Yeah, it would have been nice to see what actually happened there,
Because I think that bear, if you remember, I had a nice sized bear, because I had a mock scrape there too. And the bear was at the mock scrape like crazy. He had it pulled down to the ground, was playing with it and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And then still had buck on it after he was there. So that's crazy how that works.
No.
But yeah. He totally smoked my blind. That was really disappointing, because that was brand new, never used. Yeah. My wife had bought it for me, and I was like, oh, man. Yeah. So
what do you think? You want to wrap this episode up?
Yeah, I think it's time to put a ribbon on it. We talked a lot about gear. We talked a lot about, stuff that you want to have with you in the woods when you're going out. There's little things that you might not think about that are really important and crucial to your success outside of your stand and your other things like that. And your bow and arrow.
Yeah.
But yeah, we talked a lot about a lot of stuff like that. And then we got into a little bit of the sign and things you need to be focused on here going into the season, which I think we did a pretty good job of running over that, Dan.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you like the episode, you like the content we're producing, we have a lot more coming, more coming.
Season's getting ready to start.
This in-season content should be killer. So subscribe on YouTube, follow us on Spotify and Apple, wherever you get your podcast. And we really appreciate it. We're not sponsored by anybody. We might get some free gear here or there to test, but we're definitely not sponsored. We're just a couple guys. And that's why it's called the Everyday Bow Hunter. So there you go, Dan.
Yeah. I mean, we want to thank everybody. Like Mike said, I would like to ask you guys, listeners, subscribe, hit that like button, leave a review, send in some questions, and thank you very much. Have a good night, everybody.